Hello and welcome to the Painting Podcast. I'm your host, Jeremiah Polacek, your co-pilot on the pathway to becoming a better painter. Today we're going to take a deep dive into the unconventional and often overlooked aspects in the art world. In today's episode, we'll be challenging norms and questioning assumptions. Many of us have been taught to view art through a very specific lens, especially those of us with formal training. But what if I told you that lens might be distorting your view more than clarifying it? That's right. Today we're going to be looking at why the way you're looking at art is probably all wrong. At least if you went to art school, it is. So in this episode, I hope to anger people on both sides of the aisle. Once again, I'll probably be annoying everybody, but that's why we listen to an art history podcast that's run by a painter. So there seems to be a very particular way at looking at artwork and examining artwork. And I'm going to be getting into what it means to look at a painting. What happens when somebody in 2024, it's 2024. How does somebody in 2024 look at a painting? What's happening and how has that changed over the years? And do we need to be looking at paintings differently now? Or is there some universality in looking at a painting from 1512 and looking at one made yesterday? So we'll be getting into ideas relating to text, ideas relating to talking about art. This may seem boring, but stick around, please, because it affects the way that you look at art. And there's a very organized group. Maybe we need some dramatic music for this. There's a very organized group out there that is seeking to change the way you view art. They want to change your lens, and they want you to look at art through their lens. You have the power to look at things with your own eyes, to make your own conclusions. You don't have to read the text on the wall. You don't have to read the artist statement. You can walk up to a painting and experience it just as people have for thousands of years. All right, let's snap back to reality. There goes gravity. So let's dance through the minefield as I attempt to remain employable by the end of this podcast. We'll see if it's possible or how open to challenging norms art historians actually are. And of course, you know, disagreeing with the idea that you need background info, titles, or artist statements to get art suggests a new way to actually enjoy it. And it focuses on how art immediately speaks to you and connects with you personally. So we don't have to really, you know, just bash in all seriousness. We don't really have to bash art historians for researching and nerding out on minutiae that happened in 1567. There's other reasons why they do that. But what I'm suggesting is a new way of thinking about art and looking at art and experiencing art. And in a lot of ways, speaking about experiencing art, you know, as the only way of coming to a piece is you come to the piece and you experience it without reading any information about the artist, without reading any information about the text or whatever accompanies it, but just experiencing that thing is kind of an outdated belief. And I know that this is an outdated belief, and it's been outdated for a long time, a century probably. So what I'm trying to say is I'm not discounting research and text. I read these texts. I like to look at the art first, and then I'll read the text afterwards sometimes if I'm interested. Sometimes I want to avoid the text, and sometimes the text makes the work worse. It makes me kind of hate the work. And I'm like, oh, that was kind of a letdown. Why are you doing that? You know, sometimes that happens too. So we can go in other ways. But what I'm trying to put forward, just so we're clear, is arguing for the experience of coming to a painting and experiencing it versus one that's more analytical in nature. So the first idea I'd like to get into is the idea that art in itself is a universal language, and it's a form of communication that really transcends linguistic boundaries. So in this way, it has the capacity to evoke emotions, provoke thought, inspire insights into things, and it doesn't really need some sort of a verbal explanation. The power lies in the visual image itself and its ability to really connect with viewers across all sorts of backgrounds. They might not even, you know, speak the same language. So this really relies on the universality of human experience and emotion. So when we're all out in the Serengeti and we're camping and it's 3 in the morning and we hear that lion roar, we're going to have a similar experience and emotion no matter where we come from, right? That's going to be very, very threatening and it's going to elicit an immediate response. Now, is there a type of painting that is like a lion's roar? Is there a painting that can convey this universality? I would say yes. Of course there is. Now, this is a very difficult tightrope to walk, I will admit, because in a lot of ways, everybody is a little bit different, and our culture, which we come from, does shape the way that we look at the world, and we should absolutely acknowledge that. But what I'd really like to do in this podcast and in my argument is argue for the idea that art can transcend these linguistic and cultural barriers and also serve as a bridge that connects all of humanity. And this relies on, you know, the universality of human emotions and experiences, and it allows for a shared understanding and appreciation that transcends words, because so often we forget this is a visual medium, right? And its intention is to communicate at the end of the day and connect with people and inspire people from all different types of backgrounds. You know, you could be saying something in a work of art and you should be able to see that thing that you're saying in the work of art. This shouldn't be a controversial statement, I don't think, because there you are, you're standing in front of a painting and you can have your own personal interpretation of that painting. In a way, this actually opens up the diversity of people that can approach and experience an artwork, because encouraging viewers to interpret art based on their personal experiences and perspectives is going to foster a deeper and more individual connection to the artwork. And this kind of democratizes art appreciation in a way, and it allows every viewer to, you know, make their own meaning that is unique and personally significant to them, rather than being confined to the artist's intended message. And oftentimes that's probably why when I read some texts, sometimes I'm kind of annoyed with them. But at the same time, there is a pitfall to this way of thinking too. And that is that, you know, everything's up for interpretation. It's just your own interpretation, bruh. You know, and that can be annoying too, because there can be a very particular thing that an artist is trying to say with a painting, but if we think every single person can just interpret it however they want, then we have a million ideas and no central message. So we should look to, you know, some central themes or ideas and these sort of things. And different elements of a painting are going to appeal to people in different ways. You know, if we think about watching Star Wars, for instance, the first three, the rest don't exist. But if we're going to watch Empire Strikes Back, some people are going to relate more to Yoda, some people are going to relate more to Luke, some people are going to relate more to Leia, and so on and so forth. It's a work of art that has, you know, a lot of different people can enjoy it because their perspectives and their way of approaching the art is accommodated. And this stands in stark contrast to the way a lot of critical essays and press releases and artist statements and all these sorts of things are crafted and are written. And there's a specific way to discuss this language, believe it or not. It's called International Art English. And this is the term that's often used to describe this unique form of English that's really, really common in the international art world. And it's basically, you know, this specialized, somewhat pretentious language that is characterized by a heavy use of jargon and really obscure vocabulary and complex sentence structures. And it tries to convey an intellectual depth or a conceptual framework for artworks, but it's often completely impossible for the general public to understand. Here, I'll give you an example. This is an unknown artist, right? We'll say unknown artist, but one that I found. So,
my work interrogates the liminality of postmodernism. I deconstruct the viewer's preconceived notions of spatiality and temporality through an intertextual dialogue that juxtaposes the ephemeral with the eternal. My practice, rooted in phenomenological exploration of the sublime, manifests a critique of dichotomies inherent within us all. I encapsulate a transcendent disquisition on the ontology of perception.
Whole lot of words, not saying much, right? Yeah. Do you have any idea what that looks like? If I read you that artist statement, do you have any clue what the art might look like? Is it a painting? Is it a sculpture? What mediums do they use? We have no idea. It does nothing, right? So the purpose of these texts is often to be a signal to the cognoscenti. That's a good word to learn for the day. That'll be our word of the day, cognoscenti. It means people in the know, smart people. It's a signal to them that, hey, this person's talking about the right things. And it's framing it in a way that's smart. And then hopefully rich people will spend their money and buy it. And in this way of looking at art kind of diminishes the intrinsic value of experience itself. You know, in the age of Marvel Universe films that have explosions and are full of all these sort of sensory experiences for our eyeballs and for our ears, we just suddenly discount this when we come to a painting? That we can't just come up to a painting and experience it with our eyes? How often can this be forgotten? You know, that we're really missing the trees to see the forest or whatever they say. But you get what I'm saying. We have eyeballs. We can experience the artwork with our eyeballs. And there's an intrinsic value in experience. You know, the visual and emotional impact of a work of art is not diminished in the absence of some background knowledge about it. Rather, this way of approaching art emphasizes an artwork's immediate and sensory appeal. And that has value too, because experience has value, and art is about experience, and experiencing art is an experience. And this is nothing new, because throughout all of history, countless people have encountered art without the aid of titles or artist statements, and instead they just relied on their visual and emotional resonance with the work itself. And a lot of times the appeal of many of these masterpieces throughout the years, throughout the centuries, it's not, you know, solely dependent on an understanding of some historical or cultural context. But, you know, within it lies a sort of timeless aesthetic or emotional impact, which is being conveyed through the artwork itself. And that exists in the painting. That exists between you and the painting. And who else, of course, is impacted by this? The person that we've left out so far has been the artist themselves, the painter. What kind of situation are they being placed into? And how does it affect their creative freedom as well? A situation has been created where a lot of visual artists are also expected to write very lengthy texts about their work. And again, I'm not discounting this process. I think that this process of writing in conjunction with making can be very, very positive and very rewarding for the artist, as well as the person viewing the work. But when we think about why this language is being used, it's often being used for grants. It's being used for museums to signal that they're interested in certain things. And it's taking away from that experience of the work. And it's very, very easy to fall into the trap where the text becomes more important than the work itself, especially with the creation of, you know, the current art educational systems, which often are in research-based institutions. The people leading these courses are people that are supposed to be writing and publishing smart essays and stuff about art. That's a big part of their job. That's a huge part of their job. So a lot of young art students are being taught by professors whose sole interest is not in creating aesthetically pleasing images that convey, you know, communicate visually certain ideas. They are really spending a lot of their time writing. And the reason is pretty simple.
It's just money and tenure. They want to get tenure. They want to show a history of publishing, and then they can get that nice unicorn tenure job, and they can get more money, and they can get more funding. It's that simple. You know, I'm not saying these people don't care about the ideas that they're writing about, but there's a reason why so many art historians currently are studying extremely minute and very specific ideas rather than larger, you know, ideas. For instance, you know, who is the Neil deGrasse Tyson of art history today? Somebody who can convey these ideas in a very simple way that everybody understands? Do we really need to have all this text and all this work and all this money going towards the creation of more words when we're supposed to be creating visual things? Is that too much to ask? And when you go to a museum, you can go and experience the things by looking first and then reading. That's my advice. That's what I do. And, you know, what I do is write, obviously. So you go in to a museum or you go into a gallery show. Don't pick up the paper. Don't read the text on the wall. Walk in, walk around the exhibition, and look at every single thing individually. Look closely. Try to figure out details. Try to think for a second. Try to experience the work for a second without being told what it's about. Just go and look. And then on your way out, you can pick up the piece of paper. And when you go get a beer, you can drink your beer and read the text. And like I said, sometimes it's like, oh, that's actually pretty good. Or, oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that actually adds. Great. You know, so maybe what I'm arguing against is bad texts, right? Bad writing about art. Well, no, it's not just that. It's the fact that it's taken over. It's really taken over artistic practice, and it weighs down the importance of making and creating. If you're an art student listening to this, you know, I, I don't know how much I should say what I tell art students to do, but I would suggest, if you're an art student out there listening to this podcast, the most important thing that you can do is to create your work and make a lot of it. Get out of art school with a body of work. You can have one theme. You know, your theme can be, I make paintings of domestic interiors. That can be it. But get out of art school with 40 paintings about that one theme. You can write about it later, but you got to get familiar with your medium. And you got to get familiar with your practice, and you have to work consistently. You have to learn how to work consistently making images. And so many times that I spend so much time discussing ideas and discussing, you know, research and all these sort of things. And again, it's fine. I think that's good. I think that adds to the holistic nature of the work. But don't let it overshadow sitting there with a paintbrush in your hand and smearing around some colors on a canvas. That's how you learn to find your own voice. That's how you learn to create work that actually resonates. Because when people see the work, they're not reading the text, right? And in this way of, you know, this focus on writing also really takes away from another way that a lot of artists create work. And that's through their own intuition. You know, many artists operate from a place of intuition and emotion, and they channel their experiences and perspectives into the work. And sometimes they don't even know that they're doing it. Sometimes they can't fully articulate what is happening. And this process really emphasizes the importance of the viewer's intuitive response as well. If a painter is painting intuitively, he's naturally going to resonate with a viewer who can also have an intuitive response to it. And we should allow for this connection that goes beyond some intellectual understanding of the work to a different way of connecting simply through color, form, value, shape, line, and the rest of it. And we should also remember that art's ambiguity is one of its strengths. You know, we can invite in a multiplicity of interpretations and responses, and this diversity of response can also enrich the discourse surrounding a painting or a creation. You know, we can highlight this multiplicity of human experience within the work itself. Again, think about a song that you love, or think about a movie that you love. If it's not making sense with paintings, think about Stand By Me, the movie Stand By Me. And who do you like in Stand By Me, or who do you connect with in Stand By Me? What sticks out to you, right? We can have a diversity of people having a response to art. Or we can watch the end of a movie and one person can think that the end means this, and another person can think the end means this, and both can coexist. We don't need the director to say, okay, this is exactly what I meant in the end of the movie. You people reading the Wikipedia, stop reading the Wikipedia about what's the end mean. Just think about it yourself. And I mean, I was reading the other day that movies have actually become more and more literal in recent years as well, because they want to make sure the audience understands what's happening, because it's so difficult for the audience to just visually figure out stuff anymore. And I'm sure this has to do with, you know, TikTok and our attention spans and all these sort of things. But you'll notice it. Sometimes you'll watch a movie and they'll say, we've got to get to the reactor, otherwise the binary code is going to break and the whole place is going to blow. I'm not sure why that was like a English accent, but you get my idea. They're trying to be more literal. So what I'm asking in a viewer and how they come to an artwork, it is more engaging and it is more difficult and it does take more mind power to approach a work of art without being told directly what it is that it means. And in this way, a viewer of an artwork can actually learn through viewing as well. So the act of, you know, just experiencing art without some preconceived notion or background information can also be a powerful learning experience in itself, because it encourages viewers to trust their perceptions and their own ability to analyze and appreciate visual forms, you know, on their own. They can develop this ability. And again, this is something that's not often being taught in art schools, because they're, you know, just being too literal. They're just putting it all on the table. Here it is. Here's who he was. Here's where he's from. This is what he did that was terrible. You know, here's the historical context. Oh, then the Nazis came in and then he did the flower paintings. You know, it takes away from this ability to learn while viewing. And there's no other way to do it than just to do it. To go, like I said, to a gallery or an opening and just look. That's okay. And artists, you know, artists will lean on this crutch too sometimes. You'll go to an opening and you'll look at everything on the wall and you won't have any idea what it's about. But oh, the artist thankfully has a 2-page artist statement that you can dissect and now you're going to understand the work, right? So this is a common way that artists can also lean on this text to try and make their artwork look better and more profound or more whatever, more insightful, right? And that creates bad work. So I guess maybe I'm arguing against bad work that's supported by crappy text. Maybe that's my new revised argument. And if you're an artist that is making stuff, I hope that this isn't coming off as too doomery or too bleak, but I think there is a pathway to create work that can resonate with viewers more deeply. And I like to look at books about writing. I really like books about writing. I recommend Stephen King's On Writing or Ray Bradbury's Zen in the Art of Writing. And another great book on writing is John Gardner's On Becoming a Novelist. And this is, you know, a bunch of advice and insight that encourages aspiring writers. And I don't see a lot of these same things applied to the visual arts a lot of the time, whereas writers are kind of expected to have this different sort of work ethic and a different approach to their work. So my pathway to success would be based on this book by John Gardner and a few things that you can do to create work that's going to resonate more and going to connect better with your audience. The first thing I would suggest is to just understand your medium deeply. You know, you have to take time to really understand the intricacies of your medium and understand, you know, whether it's painting or sculpture or digital art or whatever, but understand that this includes mastering techniques, materials, and understanding the historical context of where you come from, right? But don't discount materials and techniques. This is part of, again, the current art educational structure often emphasizes something called de-skilling. And that's the idea that we should de-skill. We should take away the skills within painting. And I would argue for the exact opposite. Get as familiar as you possibly can with your mediums and different techniques. The second thing I would advise is to develop a work ethic. You know, create a system where you have to go into the studio daily and make work. You're not writing, you're not researching, you're not doing all this other stuff they have you running around doing in art school. You're sitting your butt in the chair in the studio and you're painting and you're making something. There's a certain necessity about, you know, having strong work ethic for novelists, of course, right? Because they're on a deadline. They have something coming up and they got to do 320 pages by this time for their editor to revise it and this sort of thing. But you can think of it the same way with an artist that's creating work for an upcoming show. So develop this work ethic and get your butt into the studio every single day, right? This is going to help you cultivate your own unique voice. Now, I don't like using the term style. I kind of hate style when people talk about style. And often students are like, how did you, you know, how did you come up with your style, right? And, you know, in writing, finding one's voice is critical, you know? And similarly, in visual arts, developing a unique voice will set you apart from other artists, obviously, right? But this involves experimentation, personal reflection, and an ongoing dialogue with the work itself, right? So you have to create a situation that allows you to experiment. That's how we come up with ideas. That's how we come up with new techniques. It's not by looking at somebody else and, oh, I like the way that Caravaggio painted. I want to paint like him. No, you have to enter the studio with the ability to make mistakes and experiment. Again, we're not using a very literal way of making art. We're allowing painting to be a vehicle for experimentation with technique and all these sorts of things. The next important thing would be to get some feedback, get some critique. You know, you can have constructive criticism. Oftentimes the criticism I hear is not very constructive. But you have to talk to other people, get some advice, and think about, you know, what do your peers see in your work? What do your mentors see in your work? And oftentimes you're going to have a text and then you're going to have some work, and there's not going to be a very definite bridge between these two things. They're going to seem like disparate, right? You're writing about one thing, you're making something different. There's a problem there. Maybe the text needs to change, or maybe the image needs to change, right? Because we do have to create these texts at the end of the day. You know, we have to put them out there. Ironically, as an artist gets more and more famous, you'll notice they have no artist statement, right? But that's another important thing. Get some critique, get some feedback, all this sort of stuff. The next idea is that you have to understand that being a painter is going to be a lifelong journey. It's going to be something that you're going to continue to do. And maybe you find your right voice. You do find your voice, but this is going to take time. And there's generally no shortcut to this. So you should, even when you kind of find your voice, you should still remain open to learning new techniques or experimenting with new ideas and pushing, you know, the boundaries of your art. And a lot of times this is going to create a lot of doubt. You know, this is going to create a lot of self-doubt that artists face when they're sitting there looking at their work, and there's a lot of frustration and then there's a lot of doubt. And we have to recognize that this is a part of the creative process. And this can actually help artists push through it and achieve their vision. So if you are experiencing some doubt in the creation of your works and what it all means, that can be a good thing, and that can just be part of the creative process. That's going to help you. Some other things, like we talked about today, is just the importance of the role of the viewer or the role of community in general. And, you know, having a community of fellow artists and people that are interested in art can also help propel you and make you come up with different ideas. So I would definitely suggest get out there, get to art openings, get to events where people are talking about art, even though I'm making fun of them kind of, but get out there and listen to these things and go to these talks and engage with that community. It can only help in the creation of your work if you approach it in the right way, of course. And, you know, this isn't going to be something that's instant either. You know, like I said, there's going to be a lot of doubt. And with doubt, there's going to be a lot of rejection. You're going to apply for artist residencies and not get into them. You're going to attempt to make a painting, and it's not going to work out in the way that you wanted. And rejection is a really common part of creative professions, you know? So we have to persevere and push through and be persistent. We have to know that persistence in the face of rejection is how our work finally, you know, pushes through that boundary. And, you know, as we push through this, it doesn't have to be this battle. You know, we can live a life that also kind of supports our art. You know, I just made a video recently that you don't have to get rich making art. That's okay. A lot of artists didn't get rich making art, and they still made great art, right? So you can live a life that really fuels your art in some way. So, you know, figure out what type of, you know, experiences, emotions, and observations of the world actually are fuel for your own creativity, and get more of that fuel. You know, make a point to get more of that fuel so you can make the thing on the canvas. And all of these are ideas that generally do not involve writing or precisely thinking about exactly conceptually what you're doing. You can create work, like I said before, that's more intuitive. You can try bad ideas. You should be allowed to try bad ideas. So many art students today are afraid. I don't know if it's because of Instagram or whatever it is, being so present on social media, you know, and having people be able to criticize you so immediately, but they're very, very afraid to take chances. And I think it's very important to create an atmosphere where risk-taking and chances are welcomed. That's something we also don't find often in a lot of art schools today. So to sum things up, the approach that I'm talking about understands that art is a universal language that's capable of evoking deep emotions and insights about the world without an explicit explanation. And this can foster a personal interpretation that emphasizes the intrinsic value of the experience of looking at a painting itself. And this allows for a democratic and individualized engagement with the work. This also acknowledges that creative freedom of artists can be emphasized and explored, and these artists can bring in their own personal or historical themes if they want to. And it also emphasizes the role of intuition, both in the viewer's engagement with the work as well as the artist's. This ambiguity inherent in art is going to invite in a lot of diverse interpretations, and that's going to enrich the discourse surrounding it, and it's going to lead to a better approach to art appreciation that celebrates the profound and varied human experiences that we all have. Thanks a lot for listening, and if you're into this sort of thing, please check out Oko.academy, my little art school in Prague, where I teach painting, drawing, and, you know, mentor students. You could be one. You could come to Prague. Come to Prague for 2 weeks and take classes with me. Doesn't that sound nice? Head on over to oko.academy and find out how you can do that. If this is a podcast that resonated well with you, I invite you to please hit that follow button so you can keep up with my new podcasts that are released every single Monday. And as always, happy painting.